You're listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, and I'm joined today by my colleague at the Diplomat, Prashant Parameswaran. Thanks for joining me, Prashant. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Great. It's good to be here, and we will devote this podcast again to our South China Sea update series that we've essentially been doing at the podcast simply because the South China Sea is often something our listeners are very interested in, and as luck has it, has been a very active area in the Asia Pacific for the past year and a half, certainly, and even longer. In particular, this past week was quite busy in the South China Sea, and there's been a lot of writing on these issues at the Diplomat, but Prashant and I kind of want to, you know, kick some ideas around, talk a bit about, you know, where things might go in the future over the course of this year, and just help our listeners kind of get context of everything that's going on in the South China Sea. So the big development this week actually involves China and the Philippines. Specifically, China sent reports vary a bit, but I've seen I think the number I've seen the most is five Coast Guard ships to Jackson Shoal, which is a disputed South China Sea feature in the Spratly Islands that has traditionally been a popular fishing ground for Filipino fishermen. Let me just kind of give you an idea of where it's located. It's located about 130 nautical miles northeast of Palawan Island, which is a major Philippines island that's indisputably obviously part of the Philippines, in the Spratly Islands, and it's 30 nautical miles away from Mischief Reef, which, if that name sounds familiar to some of our listeners, that's because it's one of the features in the South China Sea in the Spratlys, where China has been constructing an artificial island. So that essentially, that incident is, you know, a major show of assertion by China, which has used maritime law enforcement and Coast Guard vessels in the past to assert its claims to these features in the South China Sea, which China conceives of its maximum claim to the area in terms of its nine-dash line claim. And this particular feature falls within that delimitation. So Prashant, you know, I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on the ramifications of this Jackson Shoal incident. Specifically, you know, there are a few questions here, which is why is China doing this now? I think the timing is interesting because the Philippines and China will be seeing the decision of the Permanent Court of Arbitration at The Hague in a few months, and it seems like a particularly interesting time for China to undertake assertive behavior like this, which actually harkens back to 2012 when the two countries had their famous standoff over Scarborough Shoal. And the second question I have is, Prashant, you know, you're an analyst of Southeast Asian affairs, of Filipino affairs. What are the Philippines' options going forwards? I mean, there's an election coming up in the country. How does this change things for the Philippines, if at all?
Yeah, so I think both those questions are very good ones. So starting off with the timing, I think the arbitration case that you mentioned is definitely significant, particularly with the decision that's going to be expected later this year. I also think that you've seen a number of Chinese initiatives at the beginning of the year as well. So whether it's you know, moves in the Paracels, as well as, you know, radar activities in the Spratlys as well, that's been reported by CSIS AMTI, which does great work on this issue. I also think that there is a perception that the Chinese do want to do as much as they can before the next U.S. president comes into office. There is a perception, rightly or wrongly, that the Obama administration is probably the best that China can get in terms of a soft line on the South China Sea relative to a future administration that's going to take a much harder line, whether it's Hillary Clinton or somebody else. Some people dispute the validity of these claims, but that's definitely one consideration that some people are taking to mean why the Chinese are doing such a huge number of activities within, you know, 2016 before the election. So that's another thing to consider. On the Philippines and their response, the Philippines has always taken a multi-pronged approach to how it deals with the South China Sea, particularly because it's one of the weakest militaries in the Asia Pacific. So the decision that you mentioned, that the case that the Philippines has been pursuing on the South China Sea, the agreement that it's concluded with the United States, the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, is part of an effort to engage more multilaterally with several countries. It's also increased a lot of its security linkages with Japan as well. But, you know, to be honest, I mean, even with all the significant developments that have occurred in the last few years from the Philippine security perspective, the Philippines actually has very limited capabilities to deal with these issues. And I think the broader point that you alluded to earlier is that the arbitration case, which we've talked about in separate podcasts before, will give clarity to these situations. So when you have cases where Chinese Coast Guard vessels or other Chinese-linked vessels are harassing fishermen as opposed to Philippine military vessels, what is the case? What does it involve? What belongs to who? The validity of China's nine dash line, all of these things are very vague right now, but the arbitration case will give us at least the broad outlines of what is and what is claimed, what is not claimed, who belongs to what belongs to who exactly.
And it seems like it's highly probable that the Philippines will receive favorable judgments on all of these issues if the court does think that it has the jurisdiction.
Exactly. And the other issue to be highlighted, and we've talked about this before with respect to the case, and I think it's important to emphasize it. Even though the case gives us broad outlines in terms of, we've talked about these questions. So the validity of China's nine dash line, what are certain features entitled to in terms of, certain entitlements in international law, it doesn't really say specific things about individual features. But the important point to emphasize here is that it does give a sort of international legal cover for certain actions that could be taken by the Philippines and other countries, saying, well, this court has passed this decision, and it's clear that China's activities are illegal because of XYZ. So that's the basis on which we're doing this. This is not a something that's, outside the ambit of international law. So I think that's the important thing to keep in mind. It's very complex, but it's more.
Right, it absolutely is very complex. There's also the issue of a lot of the decisions in the case will actually come down to the determination of Ituaba, which is administered by Taiwan and is the largest island in the South China Sea, in the Spratlys, and determining if that island is capable of supporting human habitation will determine the extent to which China gets an exclusive Taiwan gets an exclusive economic zone around it and how that affects the Philippines' claims and outcome in the case overall. So yes, it's definitely very complicated, but listeners can look forward to learning about the results of that case either in late May or early June is what we've heard. Prashant, I did also want to bring up the Chinese response to this Jackson Chole incident because it's very interesting, actually. China's one of the reasons that China's been using to justify its artificial island building, its coast guard buildup in the South China Sea, is to say that it's providing public goods. It's actually going to ensure the safety of navigation, the freedom of navigation, and naturally, a lot of regional states in the United States have been skeptical of that. And true to form, after this Jackson Chole incident, the Chinese Foreign Ministry said that it had sent salvage ships there, actually, not Coast Guard vessels, to remove an abandoned foreign vessel that had run aground. And it said that, well, if we'd let this vessel linger there for so long, it might have actually impeded navigational safety and damaged the maritime environment, which is quite rich considering the damage to underwater reefs that occurs when China's building its own artificial islands. But I thought that was a very interesting response. One thing I did want to bring up is I was kind of thinking about the tactical aspect of taking control of Jackson Atoll. And you think about the fact that Mischief Reef is 30 nautical miles away, and it does make me wonder if China's trying to win an area, is trying to win an area of control around these artificial islands that it's building. Obviously, that's a very challenging feat since there are simply a lot of features to get control of, and obviously, even Vietnam controls several features in the Spratlys. But I do think you're right on the timing issue that China is definitely trying to get as much as it can out of the way before both the court decision and the U.S. presidential election. I do think that the court decision will be much more significant for China, simply because it's highly likely that come July 2016, China will officially be in transgression of an international legal ruling in the South China Sea, in many ways. And I think, if Beijing can stake out its claims before then and essentially treat them as fait accompli, because while international law does matter, power matters as well, and simply being there on the ground matters. I doubt that these artificial islands will be going anywhere after the legal ruling or the Chinese presence on them. So I think China's simply trying to make the most of the situation before that ruling comes out.
Exactly. And I think, two quick points that I'd make in addition to that. So the first is that This incident that we've seen that's very public, there are also a number of other incidents that occur that we don't hear about as much. In fact, the mayor of Kalayan Municipality, which actually was the person who broke the news, Eugenio Bito Onan, he's actually been at the center of several interactions with Chinese Coast Guard vessels that have not only harassed Philippine fishing vessels, but have harassed vessels that he's been on personally. And we actually had a story about this in The Diplomat. I think last year we interviewed him, and he had some very interesting things to say about that. I think the second quick point that I'd make in addition to that, with respect to the Chinese response, is that the Chinese, in addition to saying these things about international law and safety and the provision of public goods, they've also stepped up their campaign in terms of saying that they're doing this not only for offensive purposes but defensive purposes. And I think you're seeing the repeat of a debate that we've been seeing for a long time, which is, who is militarizing the South China Sea? And I think the Chinese will say, well, the Philippines and the United States have taken a number of moves that have been destabilizing. They'll point to the Freedom of Navigation operation, and so there's a blame game, a classic blame game that goes around. And I think as we get to the case and as we see more of these incidents, we'll see a lot more of this blame game coming up again and again.
Right, and I think that's a very good segue to the second issue that I wanted to talk about on the podcast. When you talk about militarization, the United States this morning, actually last night, locally in the United States, and a morning in the South China Sea, we read about a U.S. carrier group showing up in the South China Sea, the USS John C. Stennis aircraft carrier, accompanied by a couple destroyers, a couple frigates, a couple cruisers. Ended up in the South China Sea, and I don't know if this portends another Freedom of Navigation patrol coming up, but it's certainly going to be viewed as another example of the United States militarizing, and I use quote fingers for that, in China. China sees the presence of the U.S. Navy in the South China Sea as kind of the first move in militarization. So I think it'll be interesting how Beijing reacts to that. What do you make of this deployment, Prashant, if anything?
Yeah, I think it's very clear that the United States is trying to respond to a pattern where it's clear that we're going down the route of Chinese militarization of the South China Sea, of certain features that it's built artificially, of features that it has held for a long time. Either way, regardless of the legal complexities of the features themselves, it's very clear that the Chinese are creating a hold architecture and network of systems and capabilities that are going to allow them to, if they continue with this, essentially have a de facto air defense identification zone in the South China Sea. Now, I know that it's very controversial. Some people argue that China's not going to declare it. China's not officially going to have an AIDIS, but I think that point that is really beside the point. I think what U.S. officials will emphasize and Southeast Asian officials will emphasize is that China effectively already has a de facto AIDIS in some parts of the South China Sea. Philippine officials say they essentially have a de facto AIDIS there already. So I think the United States is responding because it's seeing a very alarming trend. And apart from, and I think this is gets to the other question which we've discussed before, apart from these freedom of navigation operations, increased presence of U.S. Naval vessels like we've seen yesterday, it remains to be seen though what else can the United States do to stem this. I mean, these assertions of presence, the presence of U.S. vessels, partnerships with other countries, maritime capacity building, all these are very forward-leaning steps. But if China is continuing to do this, what other things can the United States and other countries do?
Right, and that's a very difficult question for a lot of people in Washington, simply because there might not be anything that it can really do when it comes,
Exactly.
because these might be fait accomplis, and then you have to discuss the issue of coming to an agreement with China for the future of the South China Sea, and we might see ourselves getting there in the next administration. I do want to talk a bit about the ADIZ issue you brought up, because I'm actually one of those people who you referred to. I actually don't think China is going to declare one formally, but I absolutely take no quibble with the idea that A de facto air defense identification zone does exist over portions of the Spratlys, certainly. I think I might have written this in the Diplomat or tweeted it, but I thought that if 2015 was the year of freedom of navigation and maritime navigation, that 2016 is going to be the year where we'll talk a lot more about overflight in the South China Sea, because I think it's starting to become a lot more of an issue. You hear Chinese radar controllers asserting their military alert zone, which is a term that has no meaning under international law, but implies that they see these areas as forbidden for military, certainly, and possibly civilian flights. So this is definitely going to start becoming more of an issue in the South China Sea. To talk a bit about the U.S. response, Prashant, I think we can go on to kind of the third topic that I wanted to talk about in the podcast, which actually has to do with recent comments made by Admiral Harry Harris, who leads U.S. Pacific Command. He was speaking in New Delhi, India. And he actually made a couple really interesting points, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this. I wrote up a very long piece of The Diplomat that I can include in the description that kind of goes into where I stand on this. But I know you've also written on this, and it's definitely an important trend in Asian security right now. So basically, Harris brought up the idea of the quadrilateral security dialogue, which was back in 2006, 2007, when Shinzo Abe, who's currently the Japanese prime minister, was first in office. He was in office for a year, almost exactly, in 2006, 2007. He brought up the idea of getting Australia, the United States, India, and Japan together to start a quadrilateral security dialogue about Asia's security architecture. Back then, China was a considerably different actor. Economically, it was still booming. The South China Sea was far, far lower on everybody's radar at the time. But that initiative effectively fell apart after China expressed concerns. The Australian Prime Minister at the time, in particular, Kevin Rudd, who wanted to make the most of a good relationship with China, decided that it really wasn't worth it to push the issue at the time. But now, obviously, things have changed in Asia. The South China Sea is a lot hotter. And again, I think some people are seeing value in having this sort of coalition of democracies, so to speak, coming back together to discuss the Asian architecture. And the second issue that he brought up was the idea of India joining Japan and the United States for a trilateral naval exercise without specifying the nature of this exercise. I highly suspect it would be very modest in its aspirations, but in an exercise in the South China Sea off the coast of the Philippines. So, Prashant, both of these statements by Admiral Harris, what do you make of them?
Yeah, I think they're extremely significant, and they go back to the previous points that we've been bringing up, which is they highlight, first of all, how far we've really come in terms of the evolution of the security landscape in the Asia Pacific. That an arrangement such as the so-called Quad, which was mooted first during the Bush administration and very quickly sort of died down, has reemerged, despite the fact that various actors know how controversial it is, that it can be seen as anti-China in orientation. This is still happening, and that has to do with the declining security trends in the region, including because of the South China Sea, the appointment of new leaders in Japan and India with Modi and Abe, and the growing convergence between these countries. And I think the key word that you also mentioned in your piece and in this discussion is networking, which is the United States and these countries have very strong bilateral relationships, but trilateral cooperation has really increased during the Obama administration. Not that it didn't exist before, but it's increased significantly, whether it's in terms of dialogues that are being held between the U.S., India, Japan, between U.S., Japan, and Australia, and so on and so forth. But also, not just in terms of dialogues, but specific exercises that have been scheduled. I think you talked about, as well, the United States and Japan conducting their first exercise last year, which was quite brief and modest as well, in the South China Sea. And I think we could see similar exercises happening. I mean, the key to emphasize, though, going forward, is how the United States, Japan, India, Australia, and other actors as well are going to balance the need to have these exercises and continue to send a message in terms of the standing together, not just for democracy, but freedom of navigation and some of these other principles, with how they don't try to, how should I put it, to overemphasize the growing allegiance between them and being seen as the anti-China coalition. Although, as I keep saying, and you've mentioned this before, the more China does in the South China Sea, the more destabilizing actions that China takes, the less concerned these countries will be about that, and the less the Quad will look like an sort of explicitly anti-China coalition, and the more it would look like just responding to destabilizing actions that China is taking.
Right. Yeah, I think that's absolutely a very important point that these countries need to make it clear that they're standing for something, which is for the status quo, for international law, for freedom of navigation and overflight, and not necessarily anti-China. China made the first move and changed its behavior, and as I noted in my piece, all of these moves are reactions on the part of the United States, other regional states. So I think that'll absolutely be very important to make clear to risk, even greater rifts growing between China and these other states in the region. Prashant, I think that's all we have time for today, but thanks a lot for a great conversation.
Thanks a lot.
And if you like listening to this podcast, please leave us a rating on iTunes and make sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on future episodes. Thank you for listening.